MechCast, Tuesday, March 10th, 2015. Hey, MechGeeks, it's time for your MechCast, the show for MechGeeks by MechGeeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MechCast. Well, we are a day out of Apple's Spring Forward event, and I think it's likely no surprise that that is going to be the bulk of what we are going to be talking about on this episode. There were some surprises, believe it or not, in that event. I think many of us thought it was going to be mostly about the Apple Watch, but that wasn't the only thing that was in there, so we're going to dive into all of that. And then I've got some feedback from you on a couple of the items from the last couple episodes, specifically some follow-up to our contacts syncing issue. We had a member of our community who was having some trouble with that, and I got some great feedback and suggestions after I offered my own. And then also we're going to do a little update on managing large photo libraries. But I think we need to get into the main big topic of the day, which is Apple's announcements. And I'm going to, as I do when I kind of cover these events, just go in sort of the order that Apple announced things in, although I'm going to take the last item that was discussed, being the Apple Watch, and move that forward a little bit, because I think another product was actually the bigger surprise and the bigger story to me and left the most questions in my mind. Those are the things that I want to adjust. And you may be noticing that I did not rush to get this episode out day one. I know a lot of people want to get my thoughts and opinions after these events happen. Actually, quite a number of folks came to the MacCast IRC chat that I put together during the live event. So we got to discuss and have our immediate reactions as we were hearing the announcements from the live stream. So that's a great way if you want to get my sort of gut reactions to what's going on. Watch that. Watch the Twitter stream. But after the event, you know, there's so much, especially being an Apple fan, I think you get starry-eyed, you get bleary-eyed, you get amazed by all the great technology and the announcements, and Apple puts such a great spin on everything. You know, Tim Cook's up there, he's poised, he knows how to speak, he knows how to present this stuff. It's been planned out. And so you get, you know, what we used to call the reality distortion field of Steve Jobs. I think we just have an Apple event distortion field that happens as well. And you kind of just take everything and go, oh, yeah, that's amazing. That's wonderful. Everything's awesome. But then there's the aftermath. There's the fallout that I think a lot of us go through where you start questioning things. You start going through the details and looking at each individual item and tech spec and going, oh, well, that question's not answered. And well, what about that? And what about this? And it takes a couple days or at least a day or so for some of those questions to start to get answered. I think the press and the community goes back to Apple and they dig in a little bit deeper and we get some of those questions answered. So I like to wait and get a couple of those things, because otherwise I think if I throw the show out there, you're going to still be left with all those questions. And you've already got a lot of the first initial details either from watching the live stream or from, you know, reading stuff on the blogs and stuff like that. So hopefully we'll be able to do that in this episode. So the first thing I want to kick off with was Apple TV. And that was a little bit of a tease in my mind. I don't know how you felt when you watched it, but Tim said, hey, we're going to talk about Apple TV. And I wasn't expecting an Apple TV announcement or any kind of news related to Apple TV. So I'm like, great, we're finally going to get a new version of the Apple TV. It's so overdue. And it turns out it was an announcement we've also been waiting for, but not any new hardware. HBO Now, which is HBO's new service that is going to be just pay a monthly fee and you can get access to all the HBO content. So not like HBO Go, where you have to have an HBO subscription through your cable provider. HBO Now is going to allow you to get HBO content directly on your devices. And they're coming exclusive to Apple TV for 3 months. So they're going to launch in early April, right before the new season of Game of Thrones. I'm so excited about that. As a matter of fact, Game of Thrones just came out on iTunes with season 4. So I'm just catching up on season 4 now. Season 5 is going to be launching, and the HBO Now service will be available on Apple TV in advance of that. So they said early April. I think Game of Thrones starts like April 12th or something like that. So it's going to be the first half of April when you'll get that update for your Apple TV. As far as pricing goes, they said $14.99 a month, to get access to all of the HBO content and the past content. So there's a lot, if you're an HBO fan or like HBO shows, that could be a pretty good deal. You know, finally, we're getting some a la carte cable premium content on the Apple device, I guess, that I care about. I shouldn't say, because there is other premium content available on the Apple TV. I haven't been too excited about any of it. Some of the sports stuff is great if you're a sports fan, I guess. But I've been really looking forward to HBO coming on board. And apparently this deal was like a year in the making, and they were able to get exclusive, at least for the first couple months, which is a pretty good coup for Apple. And if you don't have an Apple TV and you're excited about this, Apple did drop the price of the current Apple TV hardware. So the third gen Apple TV is going to be $69 US. So you can pick that up. You can get the subscription for HBO. You know, I don't know if I will ultimately get the HBO subscription, because Game of Thrones is the one show that I really want to get from HBO. And I'm not sure, $15 a month might be a little bit steep just for one show. And I have pretty much been following the model where I just wait for it to come out on iTunes. So I'm about a season behind, but I get the whole season and then I can just binge watch everything. So I may wait. I don't know. We'll have to see. I'm sure there'll be a discussion in my family between my wife and myself. She might have some programs that she wants to see on HBO as well. So maybe it'll be worth the $15 a month. But, you know, the a la carte thing is something I think a lot of us have wanted for a long time. I think the dilemma is that the more and more a la carte content you get at $10 a month, $15 a month, even $7 a month, something like that, it starts to add up and get pretty expensive. And pretty soon you're right back where your cable subscription was, or maybe even higher. And with cable, you're going to get a lot more content for that same amount of money. So I don't know where that tipping point is. I guess we're going to have to start to define that. And providers like HBO and other people who are going to bring direct content to streaming devices like Roku and the Apple TV, they're going to have to find sort of that sweet spot, that balance where they get the most number of consumers, but also the most amount of dollars per month. It'll be interesting to see what happens. But Apple did also say that they've sold to date over 25 million Apple TVs. So that's a lot of consumers that HBO has available to them right out of the gate. Now, I'm sure the app probably only runs on the newer models. I'm assuming the Apple TV 2 and 3. I don't know if it'll be able to go all the way back to the original first-gen Apple TVs. They weren't really clear on that. So we'll have to kind of wait and probably find out. Then they followed up the announcements with CarPlay and HomeKit and Health. With CarPlay and HomeKit, there wasn't a lot of stuff. CarPlay, they just announced they're now in 40 models that are currently, or will be in 40 models that are shipping in 2015. Apple also announced that CarPlay has all the major auto manufacturers or automakers committed to support the CarPlay platform. And I found that somewhat interesting because we recently had a story break that Toyota still hadn't shipped CarPlay support and that they weren't really planning on it anytime soon. So while the makers have come on board and said, yes, we are going to do CarPlay, I don't think there's any set timeline. There's no set models in terms of, you know, the car manufacturers get to decide when and where they're going to implement that. So it's great that everybody's on board, but it seems like it's taking forever for that support to roll out in new car models. Luckily, we've got some third-party systems, Pioneer and I think Alpine both have aftermarket systems that you can get. And I'm particularly excited because at CES, Parrot, the same company that makes the drones, the AR drone and the new Bebop drone and the little drones that they sell in the Apple store, they have a system that will support CarPlay, an aftermarket system, and I'm excited to see what they do with their stuff. But, you know, as far as CarPlay goes, not a lot of huge announcements there. And then Tim Cook mentioned HomeKit. I was a little bit bummed about this because I was really hoping we were going to hear about some home automation stuff. That's another thing that seems like it's been a long time coming. I think there's some chipsets that have to get out into the marketplace by Marvell, and I think they just announced today that those chipsets are available to manufacturers that need to be out there to support Apple's like HomeKit system in terms of hardware. But Tim said he was going to talk about HomeKit and then said, yep, it's coming. We're working with manufacturers, but there was really no new announcements there. So I'm not even sure why it was in the slides. I think they could have cut that part altogether. And then Health was another thing that they gave us a summary of. They talked about a lot of the stuff that we already know with regard to HealthKit, and then announced actually something pretty exciting, pretty interesting, something called ResearchKit. And that was really the big news around the health side of iOS and what Apple's doing. This is a whole new framework, much like HealthKit, but instead of being for developers of health applications, this is for developers who are doing medical research or want to create medical research apps. And the idea here is to make it easier for patients to opt into medical studies and use their devices to give feedback and input back into the research study to make that whole process simpler. So they showed some pretty cool apps. They actually worked with a number of medical institution providers. They've developed 5 apps already, one for Parkinson's disease, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, asthma, and breast cancer. So they're going to have research apps for all of those. Anybody's going to be able to go and download those in the App Store, and then you can opt in to participate in those studies. So obviously, the idea is here that you might suffer from one of these afflictions and then be able to contribute to some of the research. So like I said, they showed off some pretty good examples. Like there was a Parkinson's disease app that you could do some tapping tests and some walking tests and stuff like that, and then immediately send that data back. And you could do that on a daily basis or a weekly basis. So the idea here is about getting more frequent data points, also more data points from more parts of the country, parts of the world, and they can start to aggregate that data and get a lot better picture about what's going on with a lot of these diseases and how they progress and those sorts of things. So it'll be really interesting to see what happens there. Immediately, you're probably like me, I thought about privacy. Well, what about privacy? Apple reiterated that this is a total opt-in thing. I mean, you don't have to download or install these apps. You get to decide what data you want to share, and none of that data is shared with Apple. They didn't give a lot of details, but pretty much I think this is going to be a relationship between you and the medical institution, and the data is going to flow direct. Hopefully, you know, with Apple being on board and being part of their development kit, I'm assuming all of the security measures are in place to protect that data when it's on your device, when it's in transit, those sorts of things. And another exciting thing about ResearchKit is Apple also announced that it's going to be open source. So they're going to make it available to the community and that it will be released next month. Of course, once it's in the open source, I think what happens after it's outside of Apple's walls in terms of privacy, you know, who really knows? So you're going to have to be kind of leery about that. And hopefully Apple's going to be able to control the sort of the branding and the open source in terms of how its name is attached to ResearchKit, because, you know, I love the open source community. I think it's great. But again, once that code is out there and anybody can use it for any sort of project, you know, who knows if they're going to be as sensitive or aware of privacy. Obviously, with medical stuff, you've got HIPAA and you've got a bunch of other requirements. So maybe there's some better oversight in that arena. But, you know, privacy, with all this data that's being collected about us with different sensors, and we're going to talk about the Apple Watch in a minute, you know, all the data collection that happens there, all the data collection that happens on your phone, it's certainly something that we have to be wary of and think about. And it's something that's in the front of my mind very often when I start hearing these announcements where, hey, we're going to be attaching more sensors to you and your data and information and collecting it. And I think the best tact is we just all stay on top of that. So that is kind of what they led with, that and some other numbers and facts and figures and stuff like that. If you want to see the whole keynote, in case you missed it live, it is up and available on Apple's website. But then after kind of the, almost like the appetizer, right, we get in these keynotes, they have a pacing to them. They always do. Apple goes over some numbers, some of their successes from the past couple months, and then they get finally into the actual big announcements. And in this case, we had 2 big ones. Like I said at the top of the show, I'm going to kind of flip these around and go with the Apple Watch first, because even though I thought this would be the big announcement, in my mind, it really wasn't. And a lot of what we heard about the Apple Watch for a big portion of the keynote was a rehash of a lot of things we had already heard about at WWDC. So the different styles and designs and bands and all that sort of stuff. But then they added in, of course, more pertinent details, the minute details that we wanted to know about. And those big details were things like battery life, pricing, and finally an actual release date. But before we get into that, I want to talk about the Apple Watch app, which was being released that day as part of iOS 8.2. So if you already downloaded iOS 8.2, you know that you have a new Apple Watch app on your iPhone. And guess what? It's one of these apps where you can't remove it. So whether you want an Apple Watch or not, you're going to have this app on your phone at least for a while, I would assume. Every iPhone owner is going to get this. And at first, I kind of found this kind of annoying because it's basically just a big giant ad for the Apple Watch. And then I thought about it a little bit more and thought, well, genius, it's a big giant ad for the Apple Watch. So this far out, everybody's going to be looking at this thing, tapping on it. And unfortunately, when you open it up, it says, hey, if you have an Apple Watch, you can pair it with your iPhone right now. Well, guess what? None of us have an Apple Watch. And even if you wanted one, you can't buy one yet because it hasn't gone on sale. And we'll get more into more of that here in a second. But there are some videos there, so you can look through in the what they call the Explorer section. They have the reveal video and the introduction to Apple Watch video. And then they also have the App Store. So the big thing on the Apple Watch app is that's how you're going to manage the apps and load apps and find apps and do the settings on your watch, because the watch, as we know already, is going to require that you have an iPhone to pair with it. And it's the iPhone 5 and greater. So 5, 5S, 6, 6 Plus, all those iPhones are going to work with your Apple Watch. So you've got the app on there. And then they started to get into some of the additional details. Now, some of these came out after the keynote. They weren't really talked about. And others that I'm going to be mentioning were sort of featured in the keynote. So one of the things that we had heard about and wasn't really mentioned in the keynote, but we've since found out since the press has been able to go and talk to Apple and they had the hands-on area and stuff like that, we've got some additional questions answered, was, you know, is it waterproof, water-resistant, what's going on there? And we know Tim Cook had reported that he wears his in a shower, so that made it sound like it was a little bit more waterproof than just water-resistant. But the actual facts, at least according to John Gruber over at Daring Fireball, he says in the specs, the Apple Watch has a water resistance rating. And I apologize, I don't know a lot about how these ratings work, but it has a rating of IPX7, which I guess, according to what I've been reading, means that it can withstand 1 meter of submersion for up to 30 minutes and not be damaged. So that's pretty water resistant. Again, not 100% waterproof. Apple says you don't want to submerge it. You could get, you know, have it out in the rain. It could get splashed on. I'm assuming, you know, if you're running and sweating, that's going to be fine as well. But you're not going to want to go swimming with it, I guess is the thing. And even this idea of wearing it in the shower, Tim Cook said he does it. I don't think I'd really want to wear mine in the shower and really risk getting that much water on it. I mean, if Apple's saying do not submerge, then I would be a little bit more cautious considering the price of the Apple Watch. I really wouldn't want it to get damaged. So there you go. You're going to have to make your own choice if you want to actually wear yours in the shower or not. Another thing we found out after the event was the internal storage on the watch. It had been rumored that there was going to be 8 gigabytes of storage. According to 9to5Mac, that is accurate. Although it's looking like the actual usable storage space that you and I can take advantage of is limited to about 2 gigabytes. And that's for music and another 75 megabytes, I guess, for photos that can be stored locally on the device. Photos, when you sync them over, they're going to be resed down to make them fit onto the watch's screen, which is tiny. So, you know, it's not the kind of thing where you're going to want a ton of photos on there. And so Apple's giving you that 75 megabytes, which will amount to, we're guessing, about 100 images that you can load on there. So 100 of your favorite images. And again, you're going to sync and manage those through the companion app. And same thing with the music that you might sync over there. But the good news is that you won't have to have your iPhone with you to actually be able to listen to that music. Now, you don't have a headphone jack on there, so you're going to need some sort of Bluetooth headphones to actually pair with the watch if you actually want to listen to music. Now, at the event, Apple did start to go into the metallurgy processes that they went through for developing the metals in the different versions of the Apple Watch. So you have 3 different metal choices depending upon which line you pick. So with the Apple Watch Sport Edition, it's going to be the aluminum or aluminium. For those of you over in Europe and the UK, you also have the stainless steel and then the gold. Now, I'm not going to bore you with all the technical details, but Apple was pretty proud of the fact that they had gone in and really developed unique original metals and processes for these different cases. Basically, what they were saying is they wanted all the materials to be stronger and more durable. 18 karat gold on the gold watches, that's a pretty soft metal and probably not ideal for a watch that might get banged around and stuff like that. So you don't want that to scratch and ding and dent. So they did some mixing and things like that. And they do have videos up on apple.com going into all of the information about that process. So if you want to review that, I'll just point you over to their website. But bottom line is stronger, more durable metals in the cases. And another big question that we had before this event was, you know, are we going to be able to actually do some things with the watch when it's not paired with the phone? I already told you about playing music and showing photos. As far as some of the health and fitness features, it's looking like you'll be able to use the heart rate sensor and the accelerometer on their own, and the native workout app will be able to track different kinds of workouts for anything that doesn't require a GPS. So you'll be able to use some of the built-in features, and then that data will be able to be synced back to the health app and to your iPhone when you get back in range. But the thing is a lot of people really like to use some of the third-party apps for health and fitness on their phone. Those, while they might have companion apps that work on the Apple Watch, they're not going to be able to bring data back into health or get information into the app without the iPhone as a go-between, because as we knew leading into this event, the Apple Watch itself is just kind of a display for data coming from apps on your phone. So those third-party apps have to be able to pass that information to the screen on the iPhone, whether it's through a glance or an app, what have you. That has to be sort of transmitted. You can kind of think about the watch on your wrist with respect to third-party apps, non-native apps, which Apple hasn't opened up. They said they're going to open that up at some point, but at least when it launches, that's not going to be opened up. So you got to kind of think of it sort of like an AirPlay screen for your iPhone. But Apple's own apps, which are full-blown apps, are going to be able to have some amount of autonomy. So we'll get more details as once the watches come out, we'll be able to see what works. But right out of the gate right now, we do know that some of the sensors and the built-in workout app are going to be able to work without having to be tethered to the phone. So if you're going to go running or something like that, you'll be able to use those built-in features. The battery, we had always been hearing that the battery was going to be a daily charger, that you were going to have to charge it each day. There was speculation about how much time the battery might give you leading into the event. I think most of the reports were thinking about 12 hours. Well, it turns out that was a little bit better than expected. Tim Cook claims that you're going to be able to get 18 hours in normal usage. But if you were watching the keynote and you're like me, you were probably wondering, well, what is normal usage? You know, what is the explanation of that? And I think they also claimed that it would have, quote, all-day battery life. Again, what is all-day battery life? That might mean different things to different people. So Apple actually has a page on their website that goes into some pretty good detail about the battery tests. So I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. But basically, they're saying the 18 hours included in their testing, doing 90 time checks, looking or receiving 90 notifications, doing 45 minutes of app usage and 30 minutes of a workout with music playback via Bluetooth. So that's what you can expect to get. You know, if you're using it that much, you'll get about 18 hours of life out of it. The page also shows that you'll get about 6.5 hours of music playback. So if you put the music player on and let it run for 6.5 hours, you'd be able to get that much playtime out of it. If you're using it for talk time, because it actually has a speaker and a microphone on the watch, so you can take phone calls, you can get 3 hours of straight talk time or 7 hours of workout tracking. Again, that's with the built-in workout app that Apple is including with the watch. And then another nice little piece on the battery that we found out is that the battery is replaceable. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean by the owner. There's not like a door that you can pop off and then put a new battery in. There's not a lot of details on what the procedure might be, but the best guess is it's going to be like, you know, replacing the battery in your iPhone or your iPod or even your current MacBook Pro or a MacBook. You're going to have to likely take it into the Genius Bar, and they'll be able to swap it out probably in a couple hours, something like that. So that's the guess. And we don't have any details on pricing, what that would be. But I would expect, you know, it's typical battery technology, so I would imagine you're going to get 2 to 3 years of usage out of the battery that's already built in before you're going to have to replace it. And we'll get more details later on the program that Apple puts in place for doing battery replacements. It's usually tied into AppleCare. And the watch does come with, you know, standard AppleCare, and you're going to be able to buy additional AppleCare, although we, again, don't have details on what the pricing for that will be. As far as how and when you can buy and what the pricing is going to be, it's going to vary by collection, but there is a lot of details now on Apple's website. You can actually go into the store and you can look at the different combinations, and there's different combinations of bands and materials depending upon which collection you buy into. So again, the three collections are the Apple Watch Sport, the Apple Watch, and the Apple Watch Edition. So for the Apple Watch Sport, that is going to be the two sizes, the 38 millimeter and the 42 millimeter with the rubber style sport band, $349 in the 38 millimeter, and this is US pricing, and $399 with the 42 millimeter size. Then you jump up to the Apple Watch. So there's, I think, 10 different combinations of the sport watch. I think there's 20 different combinations of the Apple Watch with the various bands and things like that. So that 38 millimeter starting at $549 US and going all the way up to $1,049. And then the 42 millimeter starts at $599 and goes all the way up to $1099. And the most expensive band in the watch collection is the metal link bracelet. And they are going to be selling the bands separately. It seems like the band prices start at $49, which is like your sport band. And then some of the leather bands, the Milanese loop, I think is $149 US. And then you've got the metal link bracelet, which is on the higher end at $249. And then finally, they announced the Apple Edition is going to be sold in limited quantities and at only at select stores. Apple didn't say exactly which stores. The Apple Watch, in addition to being in Apple stores, is also going to be available in some very high-end stores in places like France and Tokyo, Beverly Hills, I think, those sorts of places. And I don't know if they'll be carrying. I would assume those stores may also have availability of the Apple Edition watch, but you know, Apple Edition is really for the elite of elite. They start at $10,000 going all the way up to $17,000. And there's been just some craziness going on, some Apple rage going on at that pricing online. Although, you know, personally, I think it's a little bit unwarranted because they're completely ignoring the starting price point and everybody's sort of pointing at and saying, oh, this is ridiculous. Apple's selling a $10,000 watch. Well, yes, they're selling a $10,000 version of the watch, but there is a lower price point. Although, you know, honestly, $349, $399, that's pretty expensive for a lot of people, especially if you're used to paying $20, $30, you know, for a simple sport band watch. Obviously, this has a lot more technology built into it, and we could probably argue back and forth all day on the pricing, but we as Apple fans, we know anything that's first edition from Apple, they're going to start the pricing high. They're going to start with a premium product, premium quality product that you're going to have to pay for. And then over time, they'll start to vary the line. Prices will come down, those sorts of things. So this is a version one product, and we have to keep sort of reminding ourselves that. Now, 10K, that 10K watch, one thing that I was a little shocked by is, while the casing is gold and it's got the sapphire glass, the band that comes with the 10K version is still the rubber sports band. And I thought that's kind of seems very cheap to me. If I'm paying that much for a watch, I'm going to want a much higher quality band to be able to come with it. I would think they'd at least be able to do leather on that. But you're going to have to pay more, you know, thousands of dollars more, I think, if you want to jump up. I need to go back and look at the matrix. And as a matter of fact, Louis Mantilla made this awesome matrix, and I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com that shows images and pricing on all the different combinations, including the pricing of the standalone band. So I'm just going to pull it up here and looking at the Edition watch. If you want to go with that and you want to get a leather band, that's going to be starting at, for the black classic buckle, at $15,000. So it's $5,000 more than that sport band. Although you can just go, like I said, and buy that leather band. So you could get the sport version at 10K and spend $149 to get the next level up. So I'm not sure why the jump up in price when it's just swapping out the band. Unless there's something else going on there. Now that I'm looking at that, I'm going to have to try and figure that out because that doesn't make sense to me. So I must be missing something unless they're not planning on selling those bands separately. But it looks like, according to Louis Matrix, they are. Maybe it's just because there's limited numbers or limited quantity of that version out of the box that Apple feels justified in charging the higher price. But I think for most of us, you and I, we're not going to be getting that level. So that's really, really a non-issue. And if you are able to afford that, you know, and you can, more power to you. I don't understand why everybody's getting so upset, because some people are going to have the willingness and ability to buy that level of product. And if that's what makes you happy and you have the ability to do that and not put yourself in the poorhouse, then, you know, more power to you. There are also different sized bands, which wasn't really clear. They're going to have small, medium, and medium-large bands to help you with sizing. Apple actually does have a sizing PDF on their website, so you'll probably want to go check that out before you place an order. Good news is out of the box, each watch is actually going to come with two sized bands. So you'll get the small, medium, and the medium-large in the box. So maybe there'll be some band trading as well. You'll be able to trade around and maybe trade different colors. So, you know, if you need the medium large one and someone else wants the small medium, you could swap colors or something like that. So that I'm sure will be going on as well. And then as far as when you're going to be able to get these things, Apple announced previews and pre-orders. So the preview is a new thing. So starting on April 10th, you'll be able to go in. They're going to have special displays in the Apple Store. You're going to be able to see them. They're under glass. If you want to try them on, it's sounding like Apple's going to set up an appointment system. So you'll be able to, I would assume, go online, make an appointment to meet with a specialist. They'll let you go in, actually try on different bands, try on different sizes, so you can get a sense before you actually place your order of which one you might want to get. And then they're actually going to go on sale on April 24th. So on April 24th, you're going to be able to go online and make a purchase, or you're going to be able to make a reservation for an Apple retail store to go in and actually buy your watch. And once again, I think if you make a reservation in a retail store to actually make the purchase, you can tell them which one you think you want, go in, try on various sizes and bands, and maybe even be able to like change your mind at that point and say, no, actually, this one feels better to me. I want this combo, I want this band, that sort of thing. And that's going to happen at Apple stores and select Apple-authorized resellers in China and Japan. The special tables look really cool as well. Apparently, there's this employee badging system where they're able to wave a badge or get into them. And there's actually these little secret drawers hidden under the table where that'll have the different products in it. So they actually don't have to open up the case and take them out. So they'll have them all displayed out there so you can see all the different versions. And then they actually are able to pull different combinations out so you can try them on and stuff like that. When the preview goes on, you know, when the preview starts to happen, I fully expect from, you know, April 10th to the 24th, the Apple stores are going to be jam-packed. They always are anyway, but it's going to be even crazier, which is another reason why I think they're doing the appointment system if you actually want to try one on and check it out. So probably the last big question you have, because I've received many requests on Twitter and through my email, which one am I buying? And as much as I would really like to get the stainless steel model, the one that I really had my eye on was the Space Black version. And unfortunately, to get the Space Black, you have to jump all the way up to the $1,049 price, the version with the Link bracelet. And that is just way out of my price range for that sort of product. So even the stainless and stainless steel sapphire glass and sport band one is $200 more in the starting price point at $599. So you're going to jump all the way, because I want to get the 42 millimeter. So that would mean I have to jump from $399 all the way up to $599. And really the only difference is the material in the watch unit itself. So I really don't think I can justify that just for that jump up in material, especially when I figure I'm going to have it a year or 2 years. So even if it got a little more banged up, a little more scratched up, because the big argument for the stainless and the sapphire glass is that it's going to be a little bit more durable. But again, you know, the Sport Edition watch, it has the same glass as my iPhone, the Ion X glass, and I have had no issues with my iPhone. Now, my iPhone's not as exposed. I typically have it in a pocket, something like that. So, you know, time will only tell. But again, if I'm going to be swapping it out in a year or two, if I get a few scuffs or dings on my watch, you know, I wear a Pebble right now. I've, you know, got a few scuffs and dings on that. It doesn't bother me too much. I'll be a little more annoyed if it's on my, you know, shiny new Apple Watch. It even pains me to think about that right now. But again, I don't know that that's worth a $200 extra expenditure for me. So I think I'm going to stick with the 42 millimeter space gray and black sport model. Again, $399, that's more than I've ever spent on a watch. I mean, it's more than I spent a lot of my technology. So that's a hard price point to swallow. But, you know, I really want to get this thing. I'm excited about it. And, you know, it's part of my job, too, right? That's the excuse I'm going to give myself. You know, it's really because I just want the thing. But as far as bands go, you know, I think I'm going to wait for third-party bands because I think there's going to be a lot of those available. I think the watch band market is going to be just as prolific as the iPhone case market very, very quickly. And I think you're going to be able to get some nice alternative bands at a much more affordable price than the Apple ones. I fully expect to see all kinds of neat leather bands and different kinds of clasps. And I think we're going to have a lot of choice in that arena. So I'm willing to wait for that sort of stuff. A few other thoughts on the Apple Watch. Apparently, there appears to be some sort of port, at least in the demo models that Apple's been showing around, just inside one of the connectors where the band goes into place. It's looking like it's some sort of diagnostic port. Nobody's really sure what the connector is or what you would even connect to it. And it's not really clear if it's actually going to still be there and accessible after they launch. So if it will be in the shipping product or not. But that does hold, you know, some little curiosity for will there be some sort of jailbreak? Will there be some way to kind of hack and get stuff in there? And I'm sure people are going to give it a try at that. And even if it isn't there accessible, there may be even some ports, you know, inside the case that people might get at. So I fully expect iFixit and those sites to start doing their teardown and messing around and playing around with this thing. But those are the additional details. We only have, you know, about, what, 6 weeks to wait for. Is that what it is? I'd have to look at my calendar. But just a few more weeks to wait, and then we can start to actually see these things. And I'm pretty excited about it. And judging by the emails and tweets that I've received, it sounds like a lot of you are as well. So like I said, that the watch was kind of the last thing that they talked about. Right before that, though, they announced the new MacBook. And that was something I really wasn't expecting. I was thinking this was going to be a fully, you know, watch-focused event. I thought they might talk about a new Apple TV, maybe the music service gives some hints of that. But a new computer, and it turns out this is, I think, the Retina, 12-inch Retina MacBook Air that a lot of us had been rumoring about, but it is just called the MacBook. So the MacBook is back, that naming. And I think that's great. I think that's a good way to go. I think it simplifies things. And it's sounding like ultimately this will eventually replace the Air because it's actually lighter and thinner. It's super, super thin, super light. 13.1 millimeters thin, weighs just 2 pounds, 24% thinner than the 11-inch Air. And Kelly Gamont liked to point out that it is thinner than the original iPad. The original iPad was 13.4 millimeters thin. So if you're trying to get a sense of how thin this thing is, and that's on the thickest part, right? It does have that sort of tapered profile. So it gets even thinner at the front edge. And it is 67% smaller. Oh, the board. I was going to say it's 67% smaller than the MacBook Air, but no, they were showing the internals of this thing. So it's got a new sort of unibody case design, and they shrunk down the logic board 67% smaller than the MacBook Air, and they were able to remove the fan. So it's fanless and super tiny. It just sort of sits up at the top of it. They have some images on Apple's website. They also showed it off in the keynote. And then there's all these sort of nooks and crannies. And guess what goes in there? Battery. Like this thing, people joke that the iPad is all battery. This MacBook is all battery. Every square inch that they could fill with a battery, they did. They even created these sort of custom molded batteries with what they call a terraced design. So it goes down, it narrows, it thins in parts, and they really formed it into every space of that enclosure. And another cool thing is this is the first MacBook that is all metal. There is no plastic, not even on the hinges. They built the antennas for the Wi-Fi and Bluetooth actually into the bottom case. So it's going to have a nice, solid design. It looks beautiful. As was rumored, it is available in the different colors. So you've got the silver, the gold, and the space gray. One little bit of disappointment is the Apple logo on this MacBook doesn't light up. So, you know, one of the first models of MacBooks, I think, that doesn't have a light-up logo. And it's probably because the display is so thin. I think it's 0.88 millimeters. So there probably just wasn't enough space. Although, I always thought that I think the glowing logo is just the back of the LED or the LCD backlighting, right? That sort of shines through. So it was just a translucent logo. Maybe it's just so thin, you know, sometimes even in my MacBooks, if you put your hand on the other side, you can cast shadows through that Apple logo. So maybe it was just way too thin and it was just too distracting. Why, you know, I guess we can speculate a lot on why they didn't go with a light up logo. But it is a 12-inch Retina display, 226 pixels per inch. The resolution on it is 2304 by 1440. And they were able to tweak the pixels a little bit and give them a larger aperture. So I think they described it as how they generate the subpixels. They were able to move some of the mechanisms out of the way and actually open up those pixels to let more light through. They said 30% more light at comparable brightnesses to the old display. So what that really means is you can achieve the same brightness with less power. So that, again, means longer battery life. And they had a couple new technologies in here in terms of the input, new keyboard technology and new trackpad technology. For the keyboard, it's an edge-to-edge keyboard design, so it goes all the way out to the edges. Apple said this is the first edge-to-edge keyboard, but actually the 12-inch PowerBook had an edge-to-edge keyboard if you go back and look at your history. So I think Phil Schiller may have forgotten about that model. I don't know. It's maybe before his time. I have to go back and see when Phil came on board with Apple. But edge-to-edge, 17% larger keys to make them easier to type on. And they also took a look and redesigned how the key switches work. So the keys don't stick up very far at all. Again, remember, this thing is super thin, so I think thickness was an issue. And so they developed these things they're calling butterfly switches that actually sort of go down from the middle. So the current style is what's called a scissor switch. And with that, the keys can kind of rock. So if you notice on your keyboard, if you sort of hit the edge of the key, it cantilevers, right? It can wiggle back and forth. With the new butterfly switches, what they're saying is no matter where you press on the key, it's going to go straight down. So a lot more stable. They also added LEDs for each key in terms of the backlighting. So they just don't have a backlight behind the whole surface. They have one LED for each key. And something I hope, and they didn't talk about, but I hope that those LEDs are addressable, because I think that would be amazing. You could have some great typing tutor applications that could maybe light up individual keys. You could have apps that could display lit up keyboard shortcut hints to let you know where different shortcuts were. I don't know that those are addressable in the backlighting, but that would be really cool if it was. So I'm kind of hoping that is. But it does have a really shallow depth, and some reviewers have mentioned that the travel distance on the keys might take a little bit getting used to. They say in some ways it feels more like typing on an iPad than an actual Apple keyboard, but generally they agree that with a little bit of practice and sort of getting used to the different feel, that it is a pretty good feel for the keyboard. So it seems like Apple has made a good compromise between the thinness and size of the keys and the layout and all that sort of stuff. So that's good news if you're a keyboard person. They also redesigned the trackpad. It now has the new Force Touch feature, just like the Apple Watch. So sort of the harder you push, Apple describes it as almost pushing through the keyboard. And again, a lot of the reviewers say, yeah, it's this really strange sensation. So even though it's really thin, the harder you press, it feels like your finger is just traveling down into the trackpad. And I think there's some haptic feedback or Apple says they've got the Taptic engine, again, just like the watch, built into it, the little vibration engine, so you get some sort of force feedback. But I think that might be playing into it, so you can sort of feel that. And it does add some amount of pressure sensitivity. So Apple showed off that, you know, if you're doing a signature now on the trackpad, the harder you push, you can get thinner and thinner lines. No details on exactly how many levels of pressure sensitivity it has, but basically pushing deeper into it can now control different things. They gave another example of if you're in a video app and you're pressing the fast forward button, you can now press harder or deeper to make the fast forward go faster. So I think that's going to be really neat to play around with and feel. Sounds like it's going to take a little bit of getting used to. And that sensitivity, that sort of pressure, you know, how much you push on it is adjustable. So you can actually now adjust your trackpad and have it be firmer or softer depending upon how you like to have your presses. And because the whole surface is pressable, you now don't have to have a certain area. It's not just like clickable in the bottom section. You can click almost anywhere on the trackpad and have those clicks registered. So new changes to that trackpad. And the trackpad, I don't know visually, you know, how it's going to compare to current models, but it looks huge to me. It may just be because the device is so much smaller that it's the same size. So I don't know if they actually made the trackpad bigger or not, but in the images that I looked at or I've seen online, to me, it looks a lot bigger. And then another rumor that turned out to be true with this new design is that it does only have a single port. And that was shocking the first time we heard about it. But sure enough, it uses one USB-C port, the one port to rule them all. It contains all your power and data. So you're going to do charging through that. You're going to do your display connections, your USB connections, everything through that one port. And USB-C is this new standard that has been backed by Apple and a bunch of other PC manufacturers. It's looking like it's going to become the next big new standard. Some people call USB-C the dock port. So the idea of having one port that you could plug your laptop into, maybe a docking station, and then have access to all the other kinds of things that you need. USB-C apparently can carry high-speed USB data. It can also carry other signals like DisplayPort using something called alternate mode. So they'll actually let other standards travel over that connector. And it can also provide power up to 100 watts at 20 volts. And it can carry that power bidirectionally. So that means you can power your device through it, but you can also send out power to other devices like hard drives and things like that. So it kind of goes both ways. So it's going to be your power, your video, your data connection all through that port. Now, unfortunately, it's sounding like one standard that it's not going to support is Thunderbolt, and it really can't even support Thunderbolt. So if you've invested in Thunderbolt accessories, it doesn't even sound like there's going to be any kind of adapter. And my guess is that Apple is looking at this to replace Thunderbolt. I think Apple had really high hopes for Thunderbolt. We're already moving to Thunderbolt 2 and Thunderbolt 3. Some of Apple's products actually have Thunderbolt 2 connectors now, and they're bringing that on board. But I think especially in the consumer side of things with their consumer products, I think we'll see Apple sort of moving to this new USB-C connector across the board. And I know this shocks a lot of people. I was sort of shocked. I've been digging into this. It actually seems like a pretty impressive connector. The fact that there's only one is a little hard to swallow. But, you know, Apple has done this in the past, too. They sort of pioneered and put out a new connection standard, really, I think, before its time. They did it with USB on the original iMac. Remember, there was no USB peripherals when that product launched. I think a lot of people forget about that because USB is now so ubiquitous. It was the same sort of situation with FireWire. Apple was putting out computers with FireWire before you really had anything to connect them to. And with Thunderbolt. I mean, even when Thunderbolt came out, remember, it took like 6 months, maybe even longer, to really see Thunderbolt devices coming out. So Apple's introducing this new port standard first. The peripherals and accessories are going to come out long later. Now, Apple is going to have some USB accessories out of the gate. So they have a connector that will allow you to connect in and hook up AV connections. So it has a USB-C, HDMI, and USB port on a single dongle. It's $79. It supports video up to 1080p through the HDMI port. They also have a version for VGA, so a USB-C to VGA adapter, and that's going to have USB-C, VGA, and USB ports, and that's also $79. And then there's a $19 adapter that gives you just USB-C to regular USB. Now, the only problem I kind of have, and my big question on this connector is, because it carries your power and your video and your data connectivity, and you only have one, a couple of the adapters seem to have a pass-through USB-C port, but it's just pass-through. So that would give you power or connection to a display, but I'm not really seeing how on the MacBook, if I wanted to hook up power and display, through DisplayPort, because it does say that it has support for DisplayPort. You know, how am I going to do that? I think Apple says on the specs it supports native DisplayPort 1.2 video output, but there's no cable or adapter to go into today's DisplayPort monitors. So there is some information out there indicating that display manufacturers are going to adopt USB-C as a standard. So I think we're going to have, again, displays coming out that will have native USB-C connectors on them. But until that happens, I don't know how you're going to hook up your MacBook to any of your current sorts of displays. So again, this seems like a machine that's going to be a little bit for the early adopters, the people that want to be on the bleeding edge, but it is absolutely gorgeous. I think, though, like many things Apple announces, it leaves a lot more questions than answers. Some other things that you can find in the spec that are a little bit interesting in the pricing are that Apple in the MacBook is including the Intel Core M processors. These are Broadwell-based processors. They sit somewhere between the Intel Atom CPUs and their current Core series. But in looking at them, they typically have lower clock speeds and slower benchmarks than the typical Core i3 or Core i5 processors that are in, say, the MacBook Airs right now. So it's looking like these are going to be a little slower performing. We have to wait until benchmarks come out before we actually pass judgment. So I'm saying that tentatively. They have a little bit lower graphics processor as well. They're using an Intel HD 5300 GPU instead of the Intel HD 6000. So in general, it's seeming to me like these are going to be great machines for being daily drivers, for email, surfing the web, doing text editing, those sorts of things. But when it comes to heavy lifting, I'm going to have to wait and see how the benchmarks, you know, pan out. Will you be able to edit video? I'm sure. The question is, what's your performance going to be like? What's your encoding time going to be like? You might be waiting a bit longer if this is your machine of choice. And I did say USB-C was the only port on the MacBook. That's not 100% true. It's really the only port that you're going to be able to do much with. It does have a headphone jack on one side, so you can plug in a set of headphones. And there also appears to be a built-in microphone, of course, so that you can do your FaceTime calls and stuff like that. Speaking of FaceTime, too, another compromise that Apple didn't really point out but is in the specs is that the FaceTime camera is only a 480p camera. It's not an HD camera, so it's standard definition. And as George Starcher pointed out when I pointed this out on Twitter, you know, here you have a Retina display device. So you've got this beautiful high-resolution display, yet the camera that you're going to be doing FaceTime on is only standard definition. So I don't know how you resolve that and why they made that choice. Again, it's sounding like, you know, the best thing that we can guess is it must be a space issue. There must just not be enough room in that thin, thin cover to actually fit that sort of camera in. So pricing wise, these are going to come in more expensive than the MacBook Airs in their base pricing. A 1.1 gigahertz Intel Core M processor with the Intel HD 5300 GPU, 8 gigabytes of RAM and 256 gigabytes of flash storage. That's $1,299 US, so that's sort of the entry-level model of the new MacBook. And then the next level up is a 1.3 gigahertz Intel Core M processor. Same GPU, the Intel HD 5300, also 8 gigabytes of RAM and 512 gigabytes of flash storage. That's $1,599. And they're going to be available for purchase beginning on April 10th. So just some of my thoughts, additional thoughts on this. Again, these seem like some amazing machines. And at first glance, and just like I mentioned, if you're just looking at the starting prices compared to the MacBook Airs, they seem more expensive. But recognize that these machines have double the RAM of the MacBook Air lineup. And they also tend to have at the same sort of price levels, double the amount of flash storage. So if you actually take the MacBook Air models, specifically the 13-inch one, and you ramp up the options so that you are apples to apples with the RAM and the storage, they work out to be about the same price. Now, the difference being the processor and the GPU on these seem to be a little bit lower. So that's a compromise you're making, but you're gaining things like the Retina display, the newer connector technology. You're losing some of the ports. So there's some trade-offs in both directions. So they're really, in my mind, priced comparably. I think Dave Hamilton mentioned that Apple is getting dangerously close to feeling a little bit like we're back in the Performa days when it comes to their MacBook lineup now, because you now have the MacBooks, you have the MacBook Airs, and you have the MacBook Pros, and you've got Retinas and non-Retinas, and you have some with, you know, a plethora of ports, some with no ports. And it's just, to consumers, this could be very, very confusing. Apple has actually now the ability to go and do a comparison chart of all the different models. And just the fact, in my mind, that they have to have a chart with a bunch of columns to help you kind of make this decision is, I think, gets away from some of the simplicity. So I'm hoping Apple's going to cull the line at some point. But, you know, it wasn't just the MacBook that was announced. Apple did also announce updates to the MacBook Pro and the MacBook Air lineups. Some minor updates, but they still updated those. So there's, you know, some compelling, nice things there as well. The 13-inch Retina MacBook Pro, for example, is going to get the new Force Touch trackpad. It's also getting newer fifth-generation Intel Core processors, upgraded Intel Iris graphics, moving from the 6000 to the 6100, and they're also adding faster flash storage. That's on the 13-inch Retina MacBook Pro model. The 15-inch Retina MacBook Pro, for some reason, didn't get any upgrade treatment. So that's a little bit curious. Some people are worried that maybe Apple's thinking about phasing out the 15-inch line. I don't think that's going to happen. I think the 15-inch Retina MacBook Pro is going to be in the Apple lineup for a while. Maybe they're waiting on some newer Intel processors. I'm not really sure. We're going to have to dig in and figure out what's going on there. But they also did update the 11-inch and the 13-inch MacBook Air line. They're updated with the new fifth-generation Intel Core processors, new Intel HD graphics, the 6000 chips, and the Thunderbolt 2 connectors. So again, even though I think Apple is ultimately going to be moving to the USB-C connectors, they are still revving Thunderbolt on these models. And then the 13-inch MacBook Air also did get the faster flash storage, where the 11-inch didn't. So you can kind of see how Apple's kind of muddying up the lineup a little bit. But moving back to the MacBook, I think for sure these are early adopter machines. They're very sexy, very tempting. I think if you go into an Apple retail store, you know, keep your hand on your wallet, because I think when you're going to see them, and based on some of the hands-on feedback that we got, they are amazing. They are super light. So I really think the buying decision is going to be coming down to, how do you use your machine? What do you use it for? You know, those things like, if portability is your number one thing and the Retina display is your number one thing, you want the maximum portability with the highest resolution screen, and you're not so worried about expandability or your, you know, connection options if you're going to be using it mostly as a mobile device, then, you know, this is going to be a really attractive option. If you're more of a pro user, I think you're going to stick to the Pro line. If, you know, video processing and graphics image processing is your thing, these aren't going to do it for you. The processors just aren't there. The GPUs just aren't there. So that's going to kind of be the big difference. As far as battery life goes, even though these are super thin, super light, they pretty much have the same amount of battery life as the current generation MacBook Airs. So they're going to be very comparable to that. I think 9 hours, they said, with wireless web usage. So very compelling, very sexy machines. As for me, I think, you know, I prefer to have a little more port expandability. I think over time, again, the MacBook is going to become the consumer version of the notebook again that Apple sells. And I think we're going to see a little bit more variety and pricing come down as Apple maybe phases out the Air lineup and replaces the Airs with the MacBooks. Because really, and somebody else commented on this too, I forget where I saw this, they mentioned, you know, the new MacBook is airier than the Air. It's lighter, it's thinner. So it really seems silly to have the Air moniker on the heavier, sort of bigger machines. But I don't know, what do you think? I've been getting a lot of great feedback from you. I think generally, most of us are pretty happy with the announcements Apple made. The new MacBooks seem really great. leaving, you know, aside the questions of what's going on with the USB-C connection, I think we're going to need to dig into that a little bit more, get a little more details about how that's going to work. I fully expect that we're going to see some third-party hub options. I think LaCie already announced that they have a hard drive coming out that's going to use the USB-C connection. But I really want to know, you know, can you hub these things? I'm assuming it's going to work just like other USB devices and be able to use a hub. So if you need to hook up multiple USB-C devices or USB devices, you're going to have that sort of option. And I fully expect that we'll see adapters that'll do Ethernet and other kinds of connectivity. It just doesn't seem like Apple's going to offer that right out of the gate. So I think you're going to be looking at 3-6 months before you really have the accessories to go with it. So that's another thing that many of us, I think, are going to have to factor into our buying decision. But overall, I was pretty happy with the keynote. It wasn't, you know, Apple's most exciting keynote ever, but there was some good stuff in there, and I enjoyed it. And again, if you want to sort of review it, in case you missed it, it is up and available on Apple's website at apple.com. So one other thing that I briefly mentioned at the top, Apple did release iOS 8.2. We already talked about the fact that it has the new Apple Watch app in it. There were also some improvements to the health app. They increased the stability. They also added the ability to select units of measurement for certain statistics. They added the ability to add and visualize workout sessions for third-party apps. And there were some new privacy settings that let you turn off individual things like tracking of steps, distance, and flights climbed. There are also some security releases in there. Apple also did release a security update for macOS 10, in case you missed that. That addresses the recent Factor RSA export keys exploit, what's being called the Freak exploit, and also added some fixes for some security issues that affected iCloud Keychain, the IO accelerator family, IO Surface, and the OS X kernel. So you're going to want to grab that, make sure your software's up to date so that you're up to date on all of your security patches, because the Factor RSA export key thing is a pretty big deal. It affects your SSL connections and security of, you know, banking and those sorts of things. So you want to make sure you grab this update in case you missed it. And then there was also an update to the Apple TV. It looks like mostly this was, again, the security patches. It does not add yet the new support for the HBO Now update. That's going to be coming later, probably in April, when the service actually becomes available to Mac users. But with that, that was kind of all the big announcements that we had to talk about. Now, just a few more things related to some of the things we talked about on the last episode. Last time we had a listener who was having some issues with a few extra contacts that were on his iPhone that were not syncing over to iCloud. And I mentioned that sometimes you can end up with these sort of local, on my Mac, on my device type contacts when you're using iCloud. And my theory was typically it happens, or at least my experience when I had them on my device, was that I was manually moving, you know, or syncing my contacts through iTunes. This was before I switched over to using iCloud. So you would connect the cable, you'd select devices in iTunes, and then you had the checkbox, right? You could go into the info panel and you could turn on syncing of contacts. And so they were going from the on my Mac section over onto, you know, directly onto my device. And so my theory was, you know, you can go into contacts, you can go into that on my Mac section, and you can manually just drag those contacts, throw them into iCloud. That'll copy them over to iCloud. And then just make sure that you're only syncing through iCloud, and those things should sync up. But a few people after that episode aired wrote in to tell me that there's possibly a fix that's even easier. And actually, Richard was one of those people that sent in this suggestion.
Hi, Adam. Richard here from the UK. Just wanted to weigh in on Sebastian's question on the podcast the other day. Basically, I am not sure how contacts sometimes get created on my phone section. If they get synced across, I believe they get labeled as from my Mac or from my PC. But I have seen it quite a few times that people have ended up with what I consider orphaned contacts just loitering around on the system somewhere. If you want to get them into iCloud, there's a really easy way to do it. Only works for iCloud, doesn't work for any other online service. Basically, just go into the settings, into the iCloud settings, and turn off contacts. It'll ask you, would you like to delete all your contacts? Now, it sounds scary, but perfectly safe. They're all sold in iCloud. And when you then turn it back on, it will ask, would you like to merge everything into iCloud? If you go ahead and do that, anything that's stored on iCloud will come back, and anything that was stored solely on the iPhone will be merged back into that. So fairly good solution, pretty easy to do. So hope that's helpful. Thanks very much for the podcast. Bye for now.
Hey, yeah, that's going to be much easier, I think, than my suggestion. One thing I want to comment on is that option when you uncheck that box in iCloud in terms of syncing the contacts, when it asks you, do you want to keep those contacts on your device? Because I know, Richard, your recommendation is you don't have to worry about that because everything's in iCloud. I have a couple other people who said, yeah, just go ahead and say, keep those things on there. And I even emailed you back, right, Richard, and talked about this a little bit. And you said it ultimately probably doesn't matter too much. The point is you're trying to get all your contacts back to syncing into iCloud. It's just if you had some orphan contacts that were around, I think those would be left behind on your device. So I think the key here is you're going to want to keep them if, and I think this was your situation, Sebastian, if I'm remembering right, you're going to want to keep them if you have contacts that are only local that haven't synced into iCloud yet. Richard, I think you're correct if you are 100% certain that all of the contacts that you want are in iCloud. So I think there's a couple scenarios that happen here. Sometimes you might have these orphan contacts that have never made it into iCloud, right? They're only on one device, one place. You're going to want to keep those. And then when you flip it back on to iCloud, it should merge everything back into iCloud, moving those contacts up into iCloud. And I think you could come back afterwards and clean those out. Or the other situation is I've had it where every device that's connected to iCloud has all of the contacts, but then you have that one device that's just like missing a few that seem to have never come down from iCloud. In that case, if you're 100% certain all your contacts are accurate in iCloud, and I guess a great way to check that would be to log into, you know, iCloud.com and look there, just verify, yep, all my contacts are there. Then you could do this procedure, not keep them on the local device, and then just resync them back down. It's basically what you're doing is you're wiping out all of the local iCloud contacts on whatever device isn't syncing up correctly, and then basically having it pull down a fresh copy from iCloud.com. And I would even recommend, if you're going to be messing around with this, that you make sure you have a full backup of your contacts database, either on your iOS device or on your Mac, before you mess around with this. On the Mac, a great way to do it is just open up the Contacts application, go under the File menu to Export, and there's a Contacts archive that you can create, and it will export an archive of that entire Contacts database, and you could just put that off on another device, move it into something like Dropbox, get a cloud backup of it, what have you. It's actually just a good idea once in a while, too, to make a little archive of that just in case you get out of sync or something happens to your contacts. I'm always worried about my contacts getting messed up. I think a lot of us are. So always good to have good backups regardless of what you're doing. But hopefully one of these solutions is the right solution for you, Sebastian. And thanks for everyone for sending this bit of advice in terms of iCloud syncing in, because I do think it's a little bit simpler than what I was proposing. And then the last item that I have for you today, Brian emailed me with a question about large photo libraries. Basically, he's got this kind of situation, and this is going to come into play again. I didn't mention this when we were talking about the MacBook, but something that's a bit frustrating to me is it seems like we're moving backwards in terms of storage on our devices. Once we've moved into flash, because it's more expensive, we're getting less storage. So we got into a place, or at least I got into a place, and I think many of you did as well, where we were used to having 1 terabyte, maybe even 2 terabytes of local storage on our Macs. And now we're down to, you buy a new MacBook or a MacBook Air and you've got 256, you're down to 1/4 or 1/8 the amount of storage. That's a lot of missing storage. So Brian, I think, is struggling with this as well. And he's saying, you know, one of those things that takes up a lot of storage is your iPhoto library, your photo library. Those things can be huge. And it's got this single library approach. So he's like, a couple of things. You know, how do we manage backups? You know, how back up these photo libraries when it's just one giant library? You know, is it going to be slow because it has to, every time you make a small change, if I add one photo to that, you know, 1 terabyte iPhoto library, is it going to have to back up the whole 1 terabyte again? And then the other thing is like, how can we manage it just so that it's not so cumbersome? You know, if I only have 256 gigabytes of storage on my laptop, you know, I can't have a 200 gigabyte iPhoto library. I need to have something smaller, otherwise there's not going to be room for anything. So how do you manage that sort of growing collection? So Brian, I'm going to address the Time Machine question first. So while the photo library, when you look at it, you know, you go into the Finder, you go into pictures, and you look at the photo library or iPhoto library or the photo library, while it looks like it's just one giant file, it's actually what's called a package. If you control click or right click on the library file, you can choose show package contents, and it'll sort of become like a folder, and you can drill into it, and you can kind of see the hierarchy of how Apple puts that together. Now, don't mess around in there because you can break things, but it's okay to kind of look. And it's actually a good way if you run into trouble and you're trying to recover photos or something like that, you can kind of poke around in there and look. Again, make sure you have a backup of that library because you don't want to move things around. You don't want to touch stuff in there. It's really meant to be managed by the photo application or by iPhoto. But you can go in there and look, and it really just is this collection of folders. And so to the operating system, and the way I understand it, you know, with the operating system, Time Machine sees into this folder and can work with it normally like it was any other folder. So if you make a small change, it's only going to back up that differential change. The thing about it, though, is unfortunately, Apple changed Time Machine. For a while, it used to be that you could go into iPhoto, you could activate Time Machine, and it would stay inside iPhoto, and you could like sort of browse through different versions of your library. And you could go back, if you accidentally deleted just one image, you could go back in the iPhoto or the interface and actually recover an image. That doesn't seem possible anymore. Because you can't go into the individual folder, that means if you have to recover something from your iPhoto library, you got to kind of go back in time and recover the entire library. So that can be a bit cumbersome and take some time, even if you just want to get one image back. I actually, fortunately, haven't had to do this, but if I ever did, it didn't seem like it would be very convenient. Now, one thing I did notice in the new Photos application, so if you've moved over to Photos, there is, under the File menu, a recently deleted option. You can show recently deleted items, and it looks like it shows any images that you've deleted up to 40 days ago. So it kind of maintains this 40-day history of photos that you have deleted. And I think it's really just like the old trash photo from or folder or album. I don't know if it's a folder or album, but the trash from iPhoto. It's a similar thing to that. And then you could go back and recover a photo from there. And of course, you always have with iPhoto and the Photos application, your revert to your original option. But in terms of just Time Machine backups, it should be fine. You're not going to be having to back up a giant library every time that Time Machine runs. It will be able to do those incremental differential sorts of backups. Now, in terms of managing a huge photo library, it is better if you sort of have smaller photo libraries. And so there's a couple things that I've personally done to kind of manage my growing iPhoto collection. And one of them is to actually create archives and remove specific bunches of photos from the main iPhoto library. So sort of create little backup areas or archives, permanent archives of photos that I don't need immediate access to. They're ones that I want to keep and have around, but everything doesn't need to be in my iPhoto collection. I'm not looking for every photo that I've ever taken since the beginning of time. And so one way to do that is manually, you know, create albums and sort of organize things together and then export images from individual albums, either by using the export feature in iPhoto or just, you know, selecting all the images in an album and then dragging them off to a folder. You know, I like to put mine on my Drobo so that they get backed up. And then I also set those to back up to Crash Plan so they get archived off. But those will be out there. They're not in iPhoto anymore. If I want to get them back into iPhoto, I'm going to have to drag them back in and re-import them. But I can just go through that. And so it's basically exporting all of those original images and then just sort of keeping them as an archive. And another way that I like to do that is I actually use Smart Albums to sort the images by year. So for each year, I'll just create a little Smart Album filter and say, okay, just give me an album that's all of the images from 2011. And then in 2012, or, you know, when we get to 2013, I'll create a 2012 one and so on. So I have all these sort of, here's a whole year of photos. And I like to sort of archive them by year. So I'll create an archive folder and label it with the year, and then just put all the photos that I took that year in there. And then I know I have all of those off-site. And so once I know I have my archive, then I can go through and go through my iPhoto library and just start deleting, you know, anything in those yearly albums that I already archived off, I can get rid of. So I can just select, you know, a handful of images, maybe, you know, 50, 60, maybe even 100 from a given year, and just have sort of the best ones from that year. I don't need to have 5,000 from every year. I can have even 1,000. You know, however you can cull it down is a pretty good way to go. Just keep the really good ones, and then you just have your favorite and good images in your iPhoto library. It makes it much smaller. And then, you know, for the next year, you take tons and tons of photos. You just let them go in all naturally. And then at the end of the year, sort of do this cleaning, house cleaning project. You know, you spend a day and just sort of clean things out. So that's one way to manage it. Another way to manage it is by having multiple iPhoto libraries. A lot of people don't know this, but you actually can create multiple iPhoto libraries. So I've seen it where people just every year create a new iPhoto library, and then they just keep the old iPhoto libraries around. And maybe that's an easier way to handle this. So if you hold the Option key down when you open up iPhoto, it will let you actually pick a library. And whatever the last library you picked sort of becomes the default library. So if you don't hold down the Option key when you launch iPhoto, it'll just open up the last selected library. And another great way and tool for handling this is a piece of software from Fat Cat Software. And I'll have a link to this in the show notes at metcast.com, application called iPhoto Library Manager. And this actually helps you with the process of creating multiple photo libraries, splitting up photo libraries, managing those photo libraries, switching between them. It has features for things like finding and removing duplicates, which is another way to help kind of clean up your photo library. There's actually a lot of tools for helping you clean up duplicate files in iPhoto. I think MacFun has some software that'll help you do that as well. But iPhoto Library Manager will also help you merge libraries back together. So if you split up libraries and you suddenly want to merge two libraries back together, or I know a lot of people will do this where, you know, husband and wife, you both have a Mac, you each have your own photo libraries, and at some point you decide, you know what, I want to have one big photo library. We're going to take one computer and have it sort of be the master of all of the photos in the household. You can use iPhoto Library Manager to merge those libraries together. And it's a great piece of software. It's been around for a long time. As far as I know, it only has support for iPhoto. I don't know what their intentions are for when the photo application is finally out for release. I know the photo application right now is in beta. If you're in the public beta of 10.3, you probably have access to it. But that may or may not work yet. So stay tuned. I would fully expect that they plan to support the Photos application. I think the library structure underlying that library file, you know, that package contents, is exactly the same. I don't think it's changed very much. So I don't think it'd be that big of a process. But I really don't know at this point. So I'm just going to point out, if you're going to use iPhoto Library Manager, right now today it is designed for iPhoto. So I hope that sort of answers your questions, Brian. If you have any additional ones, or if you have any advice for Brian, be sure to email me, maccast@gmail.com. But with that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before we leave you, I would like to take a quick moment and thank some of my show sponsors: Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label, also Text Expander for iOS, as well as PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can find out more information and details on all of Smile's great products over at smilesoftware.com. Gazelle. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth by going to gazelle.com. And lynda.com. Lynda.com helps you learn and keep up to date with your software, pick up brand new skills, or explore new hobbies with their easy-to-follow video tutorials. You can get a free trial by going to lynda.com/maccast. That's lynda.com/maccast. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the show. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. They're at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. You can find them at backbeatmedia.com. As always, if you have any feedback for me, a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on the MacCast, you can send your comments, your emails, and I also very much welcome audio comments. If you want to just attach an MP3 file or a link to an audio file, you can send all of that to maccast@gmail.com. If you'd prefer to leave a voicemail message, you can call in on the listener hotline. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9, or if you prefer Skype, You can leave voicemail on Skype, and the Skype address is the MacCast. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. While you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you'd like to follow me online on social media, you'll find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast, or check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. And we also have a Google Plus community if you prefer Google Plus. Just search for MacCast on Google Plus and you will find us there. I think I got them all. I do this every show, but you know, every time it just seems like there's a lot of stuff. You know, you can find me. Just search MacCast on Google. You'll find all this stuff. But anyway, that's going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.